Namaste. So, we take up the human disciple this week. It was not the original title, but when it came out in book form, as we've said before, in 1923, Sri Aurobindo, instead of calling chapter 2, 1, 2, and 3 gave them all separate chapters. So this and the next have been retitled by him. So we just looked at the divine teacher. The human disciple appeared in the Arya, on 15th Arya. I don't think I'm going to be able to speak tonight. The human disciple, however it may have been titled, number 2 in the series of essays, appeared on the 15th of October in 1916. Leading in that issue was the life divine, of course, the sevenfold cord of being, one of the most seminal chapters in Sri Aurobindo's metaphysical survey of reality, one which gives us the plenary view of a cosmos far beyond the physical. The next in the issue was Synthesis of Yoga, the Modes of the Self. And there was a chapter on the psychology of social development. And finally, this one. He had begun to write about the Gita, perhaps the document from ancient India that was closest to him. So, let's read some of it. The human disciple. Such then is the divine teacher of the Gita, the eternal avatar, the divine who has descended into the human consciousness, the Lord seated within the heart of all beings, he who guides from behind the veil all our thought and action and heart seeking, even as he directs from behind the veil of visible and sensible forms and forces and tendencies, the great universal action of the world which he has manifested in his own being. So much to note there. The three terms of being that Sri Aurobindo treats extensively in the life divine and the synthesis of yoga, the transcendent, the universal, the individual, those play in the very first sentence. The Lord seated within the heart of all beings, Gita, chapter 18, shloka 61, who guides through all the great universal action. There it is, the whole universe, intimately engaged in it. Transcendent, no doubt, and yet completely committed to, suffused in being, guiding in action, every event, whether it be trivial or magnificent according to the human scale of things. This is the divine teacher, omnipresent, just like reality, a person, even invested in impersonal things, in states of being which we reckon to be absent of personality. There he is. All the strife of our upward endeavor and seeking finds its culmination and ceases in a satisfied fulfillment when we can rend the veil and get behind our apparent self to this real self, can realize our whole being in this true Lord of our being, can give up our personality to and into this one real person, merge our ever-dispersed and ever-converging mental activities into his plenary light, offer up our errant and struggling will and energies into his vast, luminous, and undivided will, at once renounce and satisfy all our dissipated outward-moving desires and emotions in the plenitude of his self-existent bliss. From the apparent to the real. Asatoma Satgamaya. Lead me from the unreal to the real. Give up our personality to and into, first to meet, to recognize and meet, to have the darshan of, and then to move into that being, not to remain outside, but to live inside, to merge ourselves into that plenary light. What does plenary mean? It's from the Latin, plenus, to fill, so it's a full light, to offer up, self-giving, not wrenched from our hands, but offered joyfully. So this is the world teacher, of whose eternal knowledge all other highest teaching is but the various reflection and partial word. This, the voice to which the hearing of our soul has to awaken. So the nature of the Jagadguru is that he is everywhere. He's in everyone, and he's beyond all, carries all within his own being. He's not outside. He's not far away. You don't have to turn to go looking for him. He's there in you. If you want to call the he a she, yes, she is there in you. I'm good with that. By the way, this idea to at once renounce and satisfy Isha Upanishad, the first verse. All this is for the habitation of the Lord. But by that renounced, enjoy. When you no longer claim it, when your ego isn't struggling to have it, then you enjoy everything because it's all that and belongs to that. Arjuna, the disciple who receives his initiation on the battlefield, is a counterpart of this conception. He is the type of the struggling human soul who has not yet received the knowledge, but has grown fit to receive it by action in the world, in a close companionship, and an increasing nearness to the higher and divine self in humanity. So let's pause for a moment. We meet the name Arjuna, which means white, clear. The Rig Veda describes it as the color of the day. RV 691, if you want to have a look. And it's interesting, in this verse, Ahas cha Krishnam, Ahar Arjunam cha. Krishna and Arjuna, in this very verse, Krishna representing the seeming black, the darkness, Arjuna, the brightness. But let's keep our eye on the aspiring human soul. He's clear. He's also silver. Arjuna can mean silver or silvery, and not gold. So he need not be the very best that's possible, but he's representative. He's good enough. He's fit enough. There is a method of explaining the Gita in which not only this episode, but the whole Mahabharata is turned into an allegory of the inner life and has nothing to do with our outward human life and action, but only with the battles of the soul and the powers that strive within us for possession. This has carried from times of Advaita Vedanta up until recently, even our dear Gandhi, looked at it in this way, that it's all allegorical, and it is not. By the way, an allegory is a narrative with a symbolic meaning. In other words, it doesn't represent what it says it represents. It represents something else. From the Greek, allegoria, voices. Sri Aurobindo again. That is a view which the general character and the actual language of the epic does not justify. And if pressed, would turn the straightforward philosophical language of the Gita into a constant, laborious, and somewhat puerile mystification. Puerile means childish. The language of the Veda, and part at least of the Puranas, is plainly symbolic, full of figures and concrete representations of things that lie behind the veil. But the Gita is written in plain terms and professes to solve the great ethical and spiritual difficulties which the life of man raises. And it will not do to go behind this plain language and thought and wrest them to the service of our fancy. But there is this much of truth in the view, that the setting of the doctrine, though not symbolical, is certainly typical, as indeed the setting of such a discourse as the Gita must necessarily be, if it is to have any relation at all with that which it frames. Arjuna, as we have seen, is the representative man of a great world struggle and divinely guided movement of men and nations. In the Gita, he typifies the human soul of action, brought face to face through that action in its highest and most violent crisis with the problem of human life and its apparent incompatibility with the spiritual state or even with a purely ethical ideal of perfection. The hour doth approach. Arjuna is the fighter in the chariot with the divine Krishna as his charioteer. In the Veda, also we have this image of the human soul and the divine riding in one chariot through a great battle to the goal of a high aspiring effort. But there, it is a pure figure and symbol. The divine is there, Indra, the master of the world of light and immortality, the power of divine knowledge, which descends to the aid of the human seeker, battling with the sons of falsehood, darkness, limitation, mortality. The battle is with spiritual enemies who bar the way to the higher world of our being. And the goal is that plane of vast being, resplendent with the light of the supreme truth and uplifted to the conscious immortality of the perfected soul, of which Indra is the master. The human soul is Kutsa, he who constantly seeks the seer knowledge, as his name implies, and is the son of Arjuna or Arjuni, the white one, child of Switra, the white mother. He is, that is to say, the sattvic or purified and light-filled soul, which is open to the unbroken glories of the divine knowledge. Kutsa means lightning bolt, by the way. So here we are speaking of Kutsa. And when the chariot reaches the end of its journey, the own home of Indra, the human Kutsa, has grown into such an exact likeness of his divine companion that he can only be distinguished by Shachi, the wife of Indra, because she is truth conscious. The parable is evidently of the inner life of man. It is a figure of the human growing into the likeness of the eternal divine by the increasing illumination of knowledge. But the Gita, starts from action. And Arjuna is the man of action and not of knowledge, the fighter, never the seer or the thinker. If you want to look that one up, by the way, Rig Veda, Book 1, Hymn 106, verse 6. And Indra invites Kutsa into his chariot and takes him heavenward. And thus the human consciousness becomes divine, communes with, lives with, is in the house with he and his wife. And only his wife can discern the difference between the two. From the beginning of the Gita, this characteristic temperament of the disciple is clearly indicated, and it is maintained throughout. So if you look at the first chapter, the 21st verse gets at that. It becomes first evident in the manner in which he is awakened to the sense of what he is doing, the great slaughter of which he is to be the chief instrument, in the thoughts which immediately rise in him, in the standpoint and the psychological motives which make him recoil from the whole terrible catastrophe. They are not the thoughts, the standpoint, the motives of a philosophical or even of a deeply reflective mind or a spiritual temperament confronted with the same or a similar problem. They are those, as we might say, of the practical or the pragmatic man, the emotional, sensational, moral, and intelligent human being not habituated to profound and original reflection or any sounding of the depths, accustomed rather to high but fixed standards of thought and action, and a confident treading through all vicissitudes and difficulties, who now finds all his standards failing him, and all the basis of his confidence in himself and his life shorn away from under him at a single stroke. That is the nature of the crisis which he undergoes. Now we'll be spending a lot of time talking about Kurukshetra and the nature of the conflict which Arjuna has to come and see before he fights. So we won't dwell on that here. There's plenty that we'll do with that later. Arjuna is, in the language of the Gita, a man subject to the action of the three gunas, or modes of the nature force, and habituated to move unquestioningly in that field, like the generality of men. He justifies his name only in being so far pure and sattvic as to be governed by high and clear principles and impulses, and habitually control his lower nature by the noblest law which he knows. He is not of a violent asuric disposition, not the slave of his passions, but has been trained to a high calm and self-control, to an unswerving performance of its duties and firm obedience to the best principles of the time and society in which he has lived and the religion and ethics to which he has been brought up. He is egoistic like other men, but with the purer or sattvic egoism, which regards the moral law in society and the claims of others, and not only or predominantly his own interests, desires, and passions. He has lived and guided himself by the Shastra, the moral and social code, the thought which preoccupies him, the standard which he obeys is the Dharma, that collective Indian conception of the religious, social, and moral rule of conduct, and especially the rule of the station and function to which he belongs. He, the Kshatriya, the high-minded, self-governed, chivalrous prince and warrior and leader of Aryan men. I'll interrupt only long enough to say that Arya is a word that means noble, like strong and swift in flight, therefore uplifted, flying above, pure, going to its home, resting on its perch. Such would be an Aryan. And if an Aryan is a hero, then remember that that comes from the Greek, heros, and similarly from the Sanskrit, vira, one who wields force for the good of all, and primarily puts down darkness and ignorance. That which opposes the law, capital L. We'll get to that law later. It is typical, again, of the pragmatic man that it is through his sensations that he awakens to the meaning of his action. Just a second, I skipped a sentence. Aha. Following always this rule, conscious of virtue and right dealing, he has traveled so far and finds suddenly that it has led him to become the protagonist of a terrific and unparalleled slaughter, a monstrous civil war involving all the cultured Aryan nations, which must lead to the complete destruction of the flower of their manhood and threatens their ordered civilization with chaos and collapse. It is typical, again, of the pragmatic man that it is through his sensations that he awakens to the meaning of his action. He has asked his friend and charioteer to place him between the two armies, not with any profounder idea, but with the proud intention of viewing and looking in the face these myriads of the champions of unrighteousness whom he has to meet and conquer and slay in this holiday of fight, so that the right may prevail. First chapter, Shloka 72. It is as he gazes that the revelation of the meaning of a civil and domestic war comes home to him, a war in which not only men of the same race, the same nation, the same clan, but those of the same family and household stand upon opposite sides. All whom the social man holds most dear and sacred, he must meet as enemies and slay. The worshipped teacher and preceptor, the old friend, comrade and companion in arms, grandsires, uncles, those who stood in the relation to him of father, of son, of grandson, connections by blood and connections by marriage, all these social ties have to be cut asunder by the sword. First chapter, shlokas 26 through 31. Should I read that? Just for the drama. This is Anil Baran's old The Message of the Gita, not the original, but 1946, the second edition. Then saw Partha, standing upon opposite sides, uncles and grandsires, teachers, mothers, brothers, cousins, sons and grandsons, comrades, fathers-in-law, benefactors. Seeing all these kinsmen thus standing arrayed, Kaunteya, invaded by great pity, uttered this in sadness and dejection. Arjuna Uvacha. Arjuna said, Seeing these, my own people, O Krishna, arrayed for battle, my limbs collapse, and my mouth is parched, my body shakes, and my hair stands on end. Gandiva, Arjuna's bow, slips from my hand, and all my skin seems to be burning. I am not able to stand, and my mind seems to be whirling. Also, I see evil omens, O Keshava. Nor do I see any good in slaying my own people in battle. O Krishna, I desire not victory, nor kingdom, nor pleasures. So. It is not that he did not know these things before, but he has never realized it all. Obsessed by his claims and wrongs and by the principles of his life, the struggle for the right, the duty of the kshatriya to protect justice and the law and fight and beat down injustice and lawless violence, he has neither thought it out deeply nor felt it in his heart and at the core of his life. And now it is shown to his vision by the divine charioteer, placed sensationally before his eyes, and comes home to him like a blow delivered at the very center of his sensational, vital, and emotional being. That is where we'll place a bookmark and finish the chapter next week. Are you sufficiently rattled? Oh, brave, courageous souls. Just the group I want to be with. So, let's read from Savitri. This is in Book 4, the Book of Birth and Quest. In Canto 3, the Call to the Quest. We'll start on page 370. Where a voice speaks, great King Ashwapati. O force-compelled, fate-driven, earth-born race, O petty adventurers in an infinite world and prisoners of a dwarf humanity, how long will you tread the circling tracks of mind around your little self and petty things? But not for a changeless littleness were you meant, not for vain repetition were you built. Out of the immortal substance you were made. Your actions can be swift revealing steps, your life a changeful mold for growing gods. A seer, a strong creator is within. The immaculate grandeur broods upon your days. Almighty powers are shut in nature's cells. A greater destiny waits you in your front. This transient earthly being, if he wills, can fit his acts to a transcendent scheme. He who now stares at the world with ignorant eyes, hardly from the inconscient night aroused, that look at images and not at truth, can fill those orbs with an immortal's sight. Yet shall the Godhead grow within your hearts. You shall awake into the Spirit's air and feel the breaking walls of mortal mind, and hear the message which left life's heart dumb, and look through nature with sun-gazing lids, and blow your conch shells at the eternal's gate. Authors of Earth's high change, to you it is given to cross the dangerous spaces of the soul, and touch the mighty mother stark awake, and meet the omnipotent in this house of flesh, and make of life the million-bodied one. The earth you tread is a border screened from heaven. The life you lead conceals the light you are. Immortal powers sweep flaming past your doors. Far off upon your tops, the God chant sounds, while to exceed yourselves, thought's trumpets call, heard by a few, but fewer dare aspire, the nympholepts of the ecstasy and the blaze. An epic of hope and failure breaks Earth's heart. Her force and will exceed her form and fate. A goddess in a net of transients caught, self-bound in the pastures of death, she dreams of life. Self-racked with the pains of hell, aspires to joy, and builds to hope her altars of despair. Knows that one high step might enfranchise all, and suffering looks for greatness in her sons. But dim in human hearts the ascending fire, the invisible grandeur sits unworshipped there. Man sees the highest in a limiting form, or looks upon a person, hears a name. He turns for little gains to ignorant powers, or kindles his altar lights to a demon face. He loves the ignorance fathering his pain. A spell is laid upon his glorious strengths. He has lost the inner voice that led his thoughts, and masking the oracular tripod seat, a specious idol fills the marble shrine. The great illusion wraps him in its veils. The soul's deep intimations come in vain. In vain is the unending line of seers. The sages ponder in unsubstantial light. The poets lend their voice to outward dreams. A homeless fire inspires the prophet tongues. Heaven's flaming lights descend and back return. The luminous eye approaches and retires. Eternity speaks. None understands its word. Fate is unwilling and the abyss denies. The inconscient's mindless waters block all done. Only a little lifted is mind's screen. The wise who know see but one half of truth. The strong climb hardly to a low-peaked height. The hearts that yearn are given 1 hour to love. His tale half told falters the secret bard. The gods are still too few in mortal form. The voice withdrew into its hidden skies. I know we have lost our great and golden friend, Ron Jorgensen. Or, so it seems, someone said he is gone. Gone where? There is only here. Open your eyes. You will see that Ron is jubilant. That golden son of the Divine Mother endures. Let him dance away. He'll return and rejoin our unending efforts on earth. Grieve if you will, if you must. He is in her heart, and he is still in your heart. If you look, you'll find him there, sitting on Mother's lap, deep inside your own beautiful self. And you are beautiful. Now, that rhapsodic poet may not be with us in the flesh. So, I expect you all to light the fire within and let music dance from your tongue into articulate phrases. Crowd the earth with beautiful poetry. Or if the muse doesn't speak to you like that, then act it out. Pour it out in action. Namaste. Jai Ma. Namaste. Jai Ma.